Thank you. Thank you for inviting me back again. Appreciate it. This talk is about theoretical models of very strange metals. This is a picture of one of the spectral functions we'll find. We can argue about whether this could be the spectral function of a metal. It builds on ideas from ADS-CFT, but actually in the end, the models that I'll describe are made of only earthly ingredients, only sort of ordinary things. So with some inspiration from ADS-CFT. So this is based on work with my grad student, Daniel Ben-Zion at UCSD, and also with Dan Arovas and Subir Sachdev and Subir's student, Avishkar Patel. Backing up a little bit, there are some metallic states that we understand well. These are described by Fermi liquid theory. They're adiabatically connected to free fermions. And one consequence of that adiabatic connection to free fermions is that the whole theory can be built in terms of electron-like quasiparticles. And the existence of those quasiparticles manifests itself in the single fermion Green's function, the retarded single fermion Green's function, as a surface of poles at the Fermi surface. So that is at zero frequency and on some locus in momentum space, the Fermi surface, the Green's function behaves like this. It has a pole with some finite residue, which is close to the real frequency axis. And this property is actually an observable property in the sense that if you do angle resolved photo emission on a Fermi liquid, kick out some shine a photon at the thing whose frequency and momentum you know, kick out some electron, measure its frequency and momentum, and the difference of those, this omega and k, are the frequency and momentum of some fermionic excitation in the system. And if you do this in a Fermi liquid, you see something like this, some linearly dispersing mode, which becomes sharp as it crosses zero frequency. And that's because the intensity of this signal that you'll see in your eyeball here, an eyeball that sees electrons, is the imaginary part of this single fermion Green's function, which if you take the imaginary part of this, you'll find that there's a delta function at the Fermi surface, whose coefficient is this residue z. And so this the existence of these long-lived quasiparticles is a basic feature of this phase. Their width, if it comes from just electron-electron interactions, goes like omega squared, more generally like some power bigger than one as you approach the Fermi surface. And the residue, which you can think of as the overlap between this excitation of the system and the bare electron, is finite on the Fermi surface. So this is a calculable theory from which one can understand quite a bit about transport in many metals. And moreover, it's a robust theory in the sense that under the assumption that the Fermi surface degrees of freedom are the only low energy excitations, it's stable under RG perturbations, except for the BCS instability. On the other hand, okay, so this is great. On the other hand, other things exist. In particular, experiments show us that there are some states of matter which have a Fermi surface, but where the single electron Green's function near the Fermi surface doesn't have a pole. Rather, there's something else. So in particular, this happens in this optimally doped regime of the cuprates above the superconducting temperature. If you do this photo emission experiment, you'll see some kind of broad excitation on some surface in momentum space. So in particular, with a width that goes like frequency rather than some larger power frequency, so that it's not really a well-defined particle. It decays before it has time to oscillate even once, and the residue vanishes as you approach the Fermi surface. And so this is a good definition of what you might call a non-Fermi liquid metal. There's still a sharp Fermi surface, but there are no long-lived quasiparticles. This photo emission data is maybe not the most prominent anomaly of this phase. More prominent is the more easily measured transport properties. In particular, there's this resistivity behaves linearly in temperature over some broad regime of temperatures, and in particular passes right through the Debye temperature without noticing. And this linear T behavior is something that we don't know how to get from any kind of robust effective theory. Usually the resistivity is smaller than that. More recently, there's another a new anomaly of this phase was discovered by several groups, which is that the magnetoresistance is linear in B. So this is a plot of, well, so one part of the data in this plot is the resistivity as a function of magnetic field. And moreover, it actually exhibits scaling between the strength of the magnetic field and the temperature. So the actual axis on this plot is the magnetic field, H, and the temperature added in quadrature. So this axis is gamma, which is the square root of the sum of the squares of T squared and B squared. And you see that there's this remarkable linear scaling of the resistivity as a function of this parameter. A large magnetoresistance means that not only is there a Fermi surface, which you can see in photo emission, but there are extended states which are extended enough to respond to the magnetic field and have it affect the transport. So this is a new anomaly that we need to understand. Okay, so let me say a little bit about theoretical models of non-Fermi liquid. There are quite a few that we understand pretty well. So in 1+1 dimensions, there are Luttinger liquids, which are certainly not Fermi liquids, where the Green's function behaves like this. So according to my definition, that's a non-Fermi liquid, but they're very special to one dimension, so let's forget about them. More generally, nearly every model of a non-Fermi liquid proceeds by exploiting a loophole in the argument for the robustness of Fermi liquid that I mentioned, namely that that argument for the robustness of Fermi liquid assume that the Fermi surface degrees of freedom are the only degrees of freedom. Whereas if we have some other gapless degrees of freedom around, we can try to couple them to the Fermi surface and use those degrees of freedom to destroy the Landau quasi-particle.
Sorry, can you remind me what happens to the 2KS singularity in these non-Fermi liquids? Is there something there?
What do you mean by these? You mean experimentally?
Experimentally. I mean, can you measure density? Do you see? When you said there, the residue is zero.
The residue in the sense of from the measured in photo emission. I mean, it's a little fuzzy. The energy resolution isn't perfect, but yeah, I would say the residue is zero. So there certainly are lots of data about density fluctuations. I'll mention some at the end, actually. Generally, a brief summary of most of the data is that things are pretty flat as a function of both frequency and momentum, and there aren't really sharp excitations. So that's consistent with the idea that there aren't sharp quasi particles. That's right. So back to describing models. So as you might imagine, there's been quite a bit of work in along the lines of starting with a Landau Fermi liquid and coupling it to some light other mode. And I guess it's natural to consider light bosonic modes, because then you could imagine some process like this, where the Landau quasiparticle is going along, it emits this soft boson and reabsorbs it, and thereby its self-energy can develop an imaginary part, where you cut this diagram. This is a picture of half of this diagram is a picture of the quasiparticle decaying into the soft boson plus the quasiparticle with a slightly different momentum. This self-energy diagram, indeed, with a little bit of doing, produces a singular Green's function at the Fermi surface. So this is a Green's function which still has a Fermi surface. That is, there's a surface of singularities at low frequency, but the form of the singularity is not a pole. It's rather this kind of weird power law singularity, whose imaginary part looks like this instead. Looks like this kind of broad excitation. And there's a long list of possible candidates for these other degrees of freedom. Some kind of, also if you just study QED at finite density, the magnetic excitations of the photon will do this, at least at some energy scale of order e to the minus 137 times the density. But more, perhaps more interestingly, in condensed matter physics, this could be an emerging gauge field or some kind of critical fluctuations of some order parameter near a quantum phase transition. And there's a huge literature on the subject to which many people have contributed, and it's very interesting. And it's certainly true that these are non-Fermi liquids, some of which we understand, thanks in large part to Slunk-Sik. A problem with this class of constructions of non-Fermi liquid is that they're not strange enough in the following sense. So when the process that kills the quasiparticle is like this, that is, the quasiparticle is going along and it emits this soft boson, the dispersion relation of the soft boson is something like this. This is Q, this is omega. Maybe it's relativistic, maybe it's Z bigger than one. In all of these cases, the density of states of the excitations of the soft boson are predominantly around Q equals zero, right? It's easiest to emit a low frequency boson, and therefore it's easy, because of the shape of this dispersion, it's easiest to emit a low momentum boson. And so that means that this process, which completely changes the momentum of the quasiparticle, in that sense it gives it a width, doesn't change very much the current that it carries. And so this process doesn't efficiently dissipate the momentum of the charge carriers. And so when there's some exponent like this for the self-energy omega to the 2 nu, this means that there's some single particle lifetime that as a function of temperature goes like t to the 2 nu. The transport lifetime, which is what determines the resistivity, will go like t to the 2 nu plus some extra factors that account for this angle. The fact that the angle of emission is very small, it's mostly nearly forward scattering. And so what I'm trying to say is that the transport lifetime will be much longer than the single particle lifetime, and so the resistivity will be some bigger power of temperature and not linear in temperature. So this means that we should try to look for other kinds of theoretical constructions of non-Fermi liquids, since we know that there exist non-Fermi liquids which have this kind of efficient dissipation of the momentum of the charge carriers. Here's a summary of the framework for non-Fermi liquid I was just describing. You take a free fermion, so this is quadratic Lagrangian for the fermion in frequency space and momentum space, and couple it to some Gapple's bosonic mode A, for example, by this trilinear coupling, so that you can have a trilinear vertex and make this kind of diagram. So that's the framework I was just describing. Another framework for making non-Fermi liquids, which I wasn't smart enough to think of myself, but rather had to be told it by ADS-C of T, is the following. Consider instead a free fermion, like the one we have here, the Fermi surface, mixing with some bath of critical fermionic fluctuations, which have some large dynamical exponent. So that is large dynamical exponent, meaning that what I mean by that is this: they have some Green's function, which scales like some power or frequency, but is basically analytic in the momentum. So it means that there are critical excitations at any momentum, basically in some window of momenta. The Green's function behaves like a power law in frequency.
What do you mean?
I mean some power law in frequency. That's the important thing. Yeah, actually, I would prefer if it's not critical in the sense that it's some phase of matter rather than having to tune it to a critical point. But it really, the important thing is that it's a power law in frequency. And then couple them. So here's the free fermion Lagrangian. Here's the Lagrangian for these critical fermionic degrees of freedom. And then one thing we can do if they're fermionic is we can hybridize them, like add some quadratic coupling. And the nice thing about doing that is we can, in that case, we can compute the Green's function for the resulting the full Green's function for the resulting electron field, just by summing a geometric series, right? So here's the free electron propagator, here's the first contribution where it mixes with this red thing, and then it's just a geometric series. And so summing that geometric series, we see that the self-energy for the electron is just equal to the Green's function of these critical degrees of freedom, which if the Green's function of these critical degrees of freedom has this power law form, will produce exactly the same Green's function that we found over here. right? It would be omega to the 2 nu self-energy. But with the additional feature that instead of the quasiparticles decaying by emitting a soft boson whose density of states is dominated at q equals zero, it decays by mixing with this basically localized degree of freedom, a degree of freedom where the low energy excitations are happen at large q. And so that has the consequence that if you get the right exponent in the self-energy, if you, for example, the case of nu equals a half, where sigma goes like omega log omega, was proposed as the phenomenological model of the strange metal phase long ago. If you get the right exponent for the single particle lifetime, because of the fact that there's no longer this business about small momentum transfer, basically the quasiparticle is scattering off of this localized thing, and so it can change its momentum by an arbitrarily large amount. In that case, the single particle lifetime controls the transport, and so if you get sigma goes like omega log omega, you get linear and T-resistive, this picture. So this is sort of a framework for making a non-Fermi liquid with efficient dissipation of the momentum of the charge carriers. Let me say a few words about this cryptic comment that it was discovered with ADS-CFT. So Sungsik reminded us some things about ADS-CFT earlier, but the basic idea is that there are certain strongly coupled large end field theories which have a simple, I should have added the word simple, which have a simple dual description in terms of classical gravity in extra dimensions, and a few ingredients in the dictionary are anti de Sitter space, which looks like this. It's some Minkowski metric plus one extra dimension, and the metric depends on the coordinate of that one extra dimension in such a way as to make it invariant under scale transformations. So if x goes to lambda x, I can rescale r to absorb that, and the metric doesn't change. And so the anti de Sitter space corresponds to the vacuum of a conformal field theory, and the symmetries of ADS are the conformal symmetries of a d-dimensional relativistic field theory. And the bulk metric corresponds to the stress tensor. If the CFT has a conserved current, that means that there's a bulk gauge field. If the CFT has some fermionic operator, gauge invariant fermionic operator, that means that there's some bulk spinner field. And so with these ingredients, we can make a state of this strongly coupled CFT stuff with finite density by turning on a chemical potential for this conserved current. And with some simple assumptions, the dual of that is putting a charged black hole in anti de Sitter space. This is a picture of a charged black hole. This end is the part where it looks like the... what's the extra dimension? According to what I was saying about the scale transformations, the extra dimension has something to do with coarse graining scale. This, at this end of the world, it's like the ultraviolet of the field theory. The thing is, it looks microscopically like a relativistic CFT. It's just anti-de Sitter space. If we're talking about a 2 plus 1 dimensional CFT, it's ADS-4. As we move in this direction, there's some kind of RG flow, which is solved by this classical gravity theory. It's just an output of solving Einstein's equations. And the interesting thing about this geometry is that there's this near horizon region, which has a very different form. The near horizon region looks like ADS-2 times R2. So this is a picture of this near horizon region. And ADS-2 times R2, according to what I've said about the scaling, means that it has a scaling symmetry only under rescaling time. So the one coordinate that participates in the ADS-2 is the time direction. There's this zeta direction is related to R. And the spatial directions don't participate in the scaling at all, right? So you can't rescale them at all. So this geometry has z equals infinity scaling symmetry. Z is the dynamical argument. And it also has one plus one dimensional conformal symmetry. Oh, I mean zero plus one dimensional conformal symmetry. So this describes a z equals infinity fixed point at large end. So many critical degrees of freedom, which are sort of critical in the sense that they have power law correlation functions in frequency, but which are basically localized in space. So now you could ask, well, why isn't this holographic construction just a solution to the problem? Why don't I just stop? And there are a few good reasons why not to stop. So the main one is that this Fermi surface, which is visible the thing that we can compute here is we can compute the two-point functions of this fermionic operator, the two-point Green's functions of this thing. Think of this as like an electron or some composite electron. We can compute that just by solving the wave equation for this bulk spinner field, and it leads to a Green's function, which looks exactly like this function here near the Fermi surface. But the Fermi surface degrees of freedom that are visible in this two-point function are only a small part of a much larger system that carries current. So in particular, their contribution to the conductivity goes like order n, where n is the parameter whose largeness makes the gravity theory classical, whereas the actual conductivity of the system goes like n squared. And so, you know, the thing is a non-Fermi liquid in the sense that there is a non-Fermi liquid in there, but there's a lot of other stuff too. And we can't really make this parameter n smaller without giving up the thing that makes this construction useful, namely that we can just solve simple differential equations to figure out the answer. And going beyond that approximation requires doing quantum gravity, which really kind of isn't so fun, and it isn't so clear how to do it in general. So I spent a little while trying to do that, and then realized it was kind of a dumb idea. And backing up from this construction a little bit, one realizes that in fact all one needs to realize the virtues of this non-Fermi liquid is equals infinity fixed point. And well, I guess we also need to have some fermions. There need to be fermionic degrees of freedom in that Z equals infinity fixed point, and there needs to be a U1 symmetry. So naturally, I was quite excited when I learned about the SYK model. This being the second talk, no one has talked about SYK. Maybe no one else is going to talk about SYK in this meeting. Is that true? Is anybody else going to talk about it? Ooh. All right, good. Okay, I'm sick of hearing about it. Okay, but having said that, it's very interesting, and let me tell you about it. So the SYK model, Sachdeviya Kataev, is this very simple Hamiltonian. This is what I mean by earthly ingredients. It's a model of fermions, and I'm going to study a version where there's a conserved U1. So at each of these little dots, there's some fermionic mode, which each one has a canonical conjugate, and we can couple them together by adding some four fermion interaction with some random coefficients. Let's take the J's to be have zero on average and have mean some normalized version of J. And in one of the many interesting things about this model is that it's solvable. It's one way to think about the solution is just to draw some diagrams. So the Green's function, curly G, I'm using the same notation as I used earlier for a reason, comes from a series of diagrams, which is there's the free contribution, and then the four Fermion interaction produces some diagram like this. These dots are disorder averages. And the leading contributions in N come from the ones where the disorder averages are sort of locally contracted. So a diagram like this, where the disorder averages get mixed up from different sites in the diagram are suppressed by powers of n. And so because of this, this becomes a geometric series in these bubbles. And so the inverse Green's function is just this bare thing minus the self-energy, where the self-energy is given by this bubble. Bubble is a square, you know, basically the cube of the position space Green's function. Now, at low frequencies, it turns out that this the Fourier transform of this wants to be bigger than 1 over omega. That is, it's going to go like a power, an inverse power frequency smaller than minus 1, smaller in magnitude than minus 1. And so that means that this thing can be approximated, this equation here can be approximated as the statement that G in frequency space times sigma in frequency space is a constant. And so we're left with these two equations. G sigma in frequency space is a constant, and sigma in position space is G cubed. And so those equations have a simple power law solution, which is this. So G, the Euclidean Green's function, this is the real-time Green's function, goes like omega to the minus a half. That is, it's exactly of the form I was describing earlier, with a particular exponent nu, which is minus a quarter. So this is very interesting because it's a very compressible state of fermions at finite density. It's very compressible in the sense that the low energy level spacing, the spacing between the low-lying excited states, goes like e to the minus n times a constant, some constant that Sabir is very proud of calculating, rightly so, which it's naturally less than log 2, since 2 to the minus 2 to the oh sorry yeah 2 to the n is the is actually the total number of states, so obviously it can't be bigger than that. But it's basically as if there were some low-lying degeneracy. And this is to be contrasted with what you would find for the level spacing in a model that actually has quasi-particle excitations, like, for example, what you would get if you took quadratic random interactions here, which is something we might call SYK2. In that case, the level spacing goes like just a power of the system size, like 1 over. Okay, a few comments about interesting features of this model. So these Schringer-Dyson equations that I've written here actually have a, in this regime where we ignore this bare part of the propagator, have a conformal symmetry. And conformal symmetry, in 0 plus 1 dimensions, the conformal map relates the line to the circle. And so that means that finite temperature correlation functions are also determined by this solution. That's useful. And another useful ingredient that we'll use is what you might call the Bath field, chi-twiddle, which is look at a term in this Hamiltonian involving an operator chi-i dagger, and look at everything that multiplies it in the Hamiltonian, and call that chi-twiddle. So that's like the mean field that the field chi sees, and because of large n, we can also compute its Green's function, which and so this is also of the form I was describing, but with exponent plus a quarter. And then finally, it's worth mentioning that this model has many properties in common with gravity in ADS2, and because there's a conserved U1, gravity plus some electromagnetism in ADS2. So it's there are some senses in which this simple model has a simple gravity dual. And the reason that I care about that is that it allows me to use the method of the missing box to make the kind of model that I was asking for. So in particular, if a single SYK cluster is something like gravity in ADS2, here's a picture of ADS2, then we can figure out. So I was saying that the near horizon geometry of this charged black hole solution looks like ADS2 times R2, or ADS2 times space, RD, however many dimensions you want, then I can make a model of that just by tiling space, this R to the D, by copies of this SYK model. Right? So it's really a very stupid thing. I just take a bunch of SYK models and make a lattice of them. So here I've drawn it as if, in the case when D is 1, because it's easier to draw. I'll also do some numerics in the case of d equals 1. But so far, nothing is special to d equals 1. And to imitate that prescription for making a non-Fermi liquid that I was describing earlier, we can do the following. So at each site of my model is going to have two things. There's going to be a dot here, which represents what I'll call an itinerant fermion, which is coupled by a clean hopping term T to its neighbor here. So this there's a T represents hopping of this fermion from here to here. That's described by this tight binding model on whatever lattice you want. And then for each side of the lattice, there's also an SYK cluster, which has its own Hamiltonian. So this is just a whole SYK model, which so far doesn't talk to anyone else. And then we're gonna couple these together somehow, and we're gonna have to talk about how we're coupling them to each other. Okay, so that's the framework that we're gonna use. Yes, please.
Psi is just an additional fermion that you're putting on every lattice.
That's right. So how to say, if I didn't add this interaction term, it would just describe if we partially fill its band, it would be free fermion metal. The goal of this coupling is to modify its dynamics so that it gets some singular self energy, so it's a non-Fermi liquid, and moreover that it's the momentum of the charge carriers is dissipated easily. Yes, please.
X independent at different sites.
It could be. So I guess I don't remember. Good point. Yeah. So actually, the disorder averages that I'll do will treat them independently, random. Yeah. So the model is not actually translation invariant in that case. In the numerics we did, I think we actually took them to be the same. I think it doesn't make too much difference. We can come back to that question. Okay. Oh, and part of the reason it doesn't make too much difference is because of the following. So I'm going to talk about two ways of coupling these two sets of degrees of freedom. The first is this sort of most directly inspired by that holographic calculation, which is just to hybridize them, right? Just add a quadratic term which mixes the itinerant fermions with the SYK cluster fermions. And I'm going to, and moreover, with some random coupling. So because this coupling is random, that breaks translation invariance. Also, and so I have no motivation for keeping translation invariants. And in the first part of what follows, I'll describe some evidence that with this coupling, there's a fixed point at finite g, which maybe we shouldn't call a strange metal. It's maybe more like a strange semiconductor, as I'll describe. And then the second thing we'll consider. So after having understood a little bit about that, we'll consider instead a density-density interaction where the density of the itinerant fermions couples to the density of the SYK modes, also by some random four-fermion coupling. And in this case, we'll find a controlled model of a marginal Fermi liquid with lots of other interesting features. Okay, so let me pause to say something about related constructions. There's been a lot of work on coupled SYK models. The first, I think, was this paper by Gucci and Stanford, where they studied a chain of SYK models coupled to each other by four fermion interactions. So by that, these red squares are meant to indicate that two of these guys are interacting with two of these guys. And this is very interesting, and they studied some interesting features of quantum chaos in the system. But it didn't solve my problem in the sense that this thing has no Fermi surface, right? There's no sense in which one is starting with a Fermi surface and you know, Fermi liquid and destroying the lambda quad particle. There's another construction by Altman and Banerjee where they studied an SYK model perturbed by all-to-all quadratic fermions. So it's again like a quadratic fermion, Hamiltonian fermions plus SYK model, but in this thing there's no locality at all. And then closest to my own interests was this work by Song, Jian, and Balance, where they studied a chain of SYK models and coupled them with quadratic couplings. So it's very similar to what I described, except that they don't add this itinerant fermion mode. We'll reproduce some of the physics that they see, and I'll say more about this model in a bit. Okay, so let's talk about the case of this this coupling, so where we hybridize them, and let's see what we get. So first, let's just analyze the thing at large n by diagrams. And so here's the free fermion propagator, here's the SYK propagator, and here's a disorder contraction. And so the full electron propagator then is again just a geometric series because diagrams where we contract the disorder lines in some other way are suppressed by powers of n. And so just like in the holographic construction, the self-energy of the itinerant fermion just is the SYK Green's function. and this is so that's nice, but it has a strange feature that I told you that this exponent nu was minus a quarter. That means that the self-energy goes like a negative power of frequency. So, you know, not only is it singular because there's a power law, the self-energy actually blows up at zero frequency. And this leads to a special function that looks something like this. So if you look at it from far away, if you look at it like not near omega equals zero, it looks like there's this linearly dispersing mode, which is becoming sharper as you approach zero frequency. But then when you get to zero frequency, the Green's function actually has a zero. So there's actually no density of states at zero frequency. It's a very strange thing. And as a result of which, the resistivity actually goes like an inverse power of the temperature. So this is naturally something you might naturally call a semiconductor.
Hello.
Yes.
So this psi fermion will induce a quadratic term for chi on the solution.
Yeah, yeah, so I'll come back to that in just a second. Yeah, so indeed, that's the subject of the next slide. Let me comment on these weird features a little more. So you might have hoped to find an example where this was a positive power of frequency. And one way to try to generalize the construction is to consider an SYK model where instead of four Fermion interactions, we consider Q Fermion interactions. I guess I should have mentioned this earlier. In that case, the exponent nu, instead of being minus a quarter, it becomes 1 minus Q over 2Q, as you can see by redoing that simple Schringer-Dyson analysis. And so as a function of Q, that looks something like this. This is nu as a function of Q. And the bath field for general Q looks something like this. And so it's true that the bath field gives a positive power for some range of Q between four. Anyway, so this is the set of exponents that you can get by this immediate construction. So let's address Sung-Sik's question. So does this coupling to the Fermi surface destroy the SYK clusters? Right? You might think that, you know, we have these localized modes and we're coupling them to an itinerant mode. You might think that that might delocalize them. Yes, please.
Yeah, sorry, just a quick question about the previous slide. If instead of a quadratic coupling with fermions, you have a quadratic coupling with the bath field, would that give a linear T or like a square root of T?
Right, so the natural guess would be it's square root of T, that's right. And that is indeed what happens at large N. So if you take large N first before doing anything else, indeed you get the self-energy is omega to the 1/2, and the resistivity goes like square root of T. But as I'll describe, the low frequency behavior is very different. The low temperature behavior is very different if you take temperature to zero before you take N to infinity. Yes, that's right. So this is the propagator for the localized fermion. That's the red line, and it gets contributions from diagrams like this. And there's an important pattern in these diagrams, which is that the short version of this statement is that at leading order in 1/n, the SYK Green's function is still exactly local. The average SYK Green's function is exactly local. And contributions which are suppressed by n are less singular than omega to the minus 1/2. And not only are they local, but they're less singular. And so the z equals infinity behavior survives this coupling, at least in the large n limit. One other point of view on this calculation, which is sometimes useful, is it's possible to write the replicated partition function for this system as a simple bosonic path integral, where the variables in the path integral are the Green's function, the self-energy, and some basically the self-energy of the itinerant modes. And at large n, this path integral is dominated by a saddle point. And the condition for the saddle point is exactly the Schringer-Dyson equations that we solved. So that's a useful point of view on the large N calculation. But an important question about the large N calculation is the one that was just raised, which is, in general, taking N to infinity doesn't commute with taking the low energy limit. In trying to describe physics of a material not realistically, but with some measure of fidelity, one is generally interested not in having an infinite number of degrees of freedom at each site before taking the low energy limit. And so, this is actually the right order in which to do it, whereas this is the order in which the calculation I just described. And so to approach understanding what happens at finite n, let's back up a little bit. And think about, rather than thinking about this model I was just describing, which is a bit like a Kondo lattice model, where we have some conduction electrons which are coupled locally, to some lattice of impurities. Let's consider instead just a single impurity, just a single SYK cluster coupled to a Fermi surface, coupled to this itinerant mode. And so in that case, just like in Kondo physics, only the S wave mode of that conduction electron couples to the impurity. And so the Hamiltonian for the S wave mode is some one-dimensional free fermion with a left mover and a right mover. And so simple dimensional analysis says that their dimensions are a half. And we're going to perturb this free fermion Hamiltonian by a coupling to this fermionic impurity. And we're going to consider three possibilities for that perturbation. One is coupling it to the Bath field. Sorry, one is coupling it to the SYK fermion. Another is coupling it to the Bath field. And the third is this density-density coupling. And we can, using this fact, we can figure out which how these couplings will run under the RG. And so in particular, this coupling to this hybridization that we've been talking about is indeed a relevant perturbation. It has dimension minus a quarter. The coupling to the Bath field, however, is irrelevant. Exactly because the Bath field has exponent a quarter. And the density coupling also is an irrelevant perturbation. So that's thinking about like weak coupling of this free fermion to this impurity. Let's think about strong coupling. So if we think about large enough G, this hybridization coupling, much bigger than the other scales in the problem, like the in particular much bigger than the SYK J, then we can just solve the quadratic Hamiltonian first. So it's a highly underscreened Kondo problem, in the sense that we have one conduction electron, but many, many impurity orbitals. And so and diagonalizing this Hamiltonian, we start with the flat band for the impurities in this itinerant mode, and hybridizing just produces a gap, right? So this is an interesting phenomenon. It's like you might call it a reverse Kondo effect. So usually the Kondo effect is you have some spin impurity coupled to the conduction electrons, and then the spin of the conduction electrons just absorb that spin into themselves, and the spin disappears, right? And there's basically no more impurity. Here it's the opposite. Here we have many orbitals, localized orbitals, and there are so many of them that the impurities eat the conduction electron. So it's sort of, the reverse of the Kondo effect. And so having understood these two ends of the space of couplings, we can get some idea of what happens in the middle. So in particular, the beta function for this coupling G, here's G, here's the beta function for G. The data that I just described shows that at small coupling, it's positive in the sense that it's a relevant perturbation. And at large coupling, it's positive. It's a relevant perturbation to flow to this gapped fixed point with this reverse Kondo phase. And so the possibilities for what happened in the middle are these three. Either it just goes directly from this weak coupling fixed point, the relevant perturbation takes you directly to this phase where the impurities eat the conduction electron, or there's some fixed point in the middle. And the case where there's only one fixed point in the middle, it requires fine tuning. In fact, to make this picture, I had to do some fine tuning. it's good proof that there's fine tuning required. And so generically, if we find evidence for a fixed point in the middle between weak and strong coupling, it's a stable fixed point, right? Because the RG arrows are going this way here and this way here. So this fixed point is stable in the G direction. Okay, and one way to try to diagnose that is to do some numerics, right? So the nice thing about this construction is, in the holographic construction, to do finite n, we had to do quantum gravity. Right, but in this construction, to do finite n, we just have to do DMRG. It's much better. So we did some DMRG, and the diagnostic that if you do DMRG, a simple thing to do is to look at the entanglement of half of the system. Right, that information is built into the calculation, and so let's use that as a diagnostic for which of these two possibilities is realized. So in the case where it just flows directly from weak coupling to strong coupling, we'd expect that. At short distances, so this axis is log of the full system size. And I'm cutting it in half and measuring the half chain entanglement entropy as a function of that full system size. And so it's at small coupling, it should look just like a free fermion. The entanglement entropy of half the chain should go like C over 3 log L. C is 1. But in this case, it should just go directly to a state with a finite correlation length. So the entanglement should just saturate at log of C at some value that some crossover length that depends on the size of this perturbation. It should go like Gn to some negative power based on just dimensional analysis. Whereas if there's some intermediate coupling fixed point, we'd expect that a weak coupling, it still behaves like free fermions, but then as you cross over to this other fixed point, it should behave like a one-dimensional critical theory with some different value of the central charge. Now, central charge is maybe not the right word to use since the thing is fundamentally non-relativistic, but we'd expect that there's some area law violation with some coefficient which is different from the free fermion value and bigger since we're adding degrees of freedom. So this is what happened. So this is the half-chain entanglement entropy as a function of the system size. And indeed, it as we increase the coupling for a little while, it grows faster with L than the free fermion answer. It's not, the system sizes aren't so big, the bond dimension isn't that great, but a few comparisons. If we instead use the coupling to the back field, we don't see this phenomenon at all. It just remains exactly the same as the free fermion answer. That's consistent with it being an irrelevant perturbation in that case. If we instead use SYK2 clusters, so that the whole system is just quadratic, the whole Hamiltonian is just quadratic, in that case we can do much bigger system sizes because of Ingo Peschel. And we don't see the same phenomenon. It clusters at the free fermion value and then maybe localizes a little bit. And so this is some evidence that something good is happening. And so we can try to extract the coefficient of the log L, what would be the central charge if it were a relativistic CFT, as a function of G. So this is basically C, the coefficient of 1 over 3 log L, as a function of the size of the bare perturbation. And you see that for a while, it's some smoothly varying, increasing function of G. And then if you make G too big, all the entanglement goes away, and this is what I'm calling this reverse Kondo phase at large G. So this is some numerical evidence for the existence of some interesting fixed point, I think. We can also compute correlation functions in this calculation. So this is the itinerant fermion-Green's function at two places as a function of, one of them is at half, is in the middle, the other one is, we're varying on this direction. As a function of G is increasing in this direction, so you see this looks, at G very small, it looks like the free fermion answer, which is sine 2kf x over x to the 1 is the free fermion value. And as we increase G, that power decreases, actually. But if we make G big enough, everybody is localized. And the localized fermion Green's function is indeed always localized. Okay, so that's consistent with my claim at large N that the coupling to the itinerant fermions doesn't delocalize the localized fermions. Now, admittedly, this is in one dimension where, Anderson localization works in the favor of localizing things. So I'm not sure how strong evidence this is, but it's something. So there's some evidence for an interesting non-fermion liquid fixed point, or at least some kind of fixed point. It's definitely not Lorentz invariant. Although the numerical evidence was in one dimension, it's definitely not a Luttinger liquid because of the fact that this coefficient of log L in the entanglement entropy was not equal to 1. So it has a different central charge than a Luttinger liquid. One thing we can try to do to access the thing a little more precisely is the analog of the epsilon expansion. The analog of the epsilon expansion is we want to choose vary the parameter so that the coupling becomes marginal, right? The perturbation becomes marginal. And that indeed happens when Q goes to 2 plus epsilon, where Q is the number of powers of the fermion operator. And so we can indeed we can do some perturbation theory and compute the beta function for G squared in that limit. And it has this behavior. So in particular, there is a fixed point at weak coupling. And moreover, so this minus sign says there is a fixed point. And moreover, the coefficient of the one loop contribution to the beta function is suppressed by powers of Kf, by powers of the size of the Fermi surface. So that's some evidence that maybe we can trust this calculation you know, when we set epsilon equal to 2. yeah, maybe. Okay. So it has a Fermi surface, but it's not a metal. So this, it's something like a strange semiconductor. Okay, so so you might say that based on this argument, any time the perturbation is relevant, you'll get a negative power of frequency in the self-energy. And so when Avishkar Patel came to visit UCSD, he convinced me that I was asking too much by demanding an infrared fixed point. And you know, why don't we try to understand what happens when we add this irrelevant perturbation instead? So let's consider, and soon after, another group of Chowdhury, Werman, Berg, and Senthal also studied a very similar model. So same ingredients, so Fermi surface coupled to SYK clusters, but now by this density-density coupling. And again, it can be solved by solving some Schwinger-Dyson equations. It's slightly more complicated, but the important ingredient is that the itinerant fermion and the localized fermion are coupled only by the local density of states of the itinerant fermion, which under some assumptions is just, well, okay, assuming that an infinite bandwidth is just proportional to the Sigyn function. And this means we can do the integrals. And so the effect on the itinerant fermions of this coupling is comes from this, basically from this one loop diagram. It gives a self-energy which goes like omega log omega, which is this marginal Fermi liquid behavior. More precisely, at Euclidean frequency and finite temperature, it's this function. And this has the consequence that the single particle decay rate, which is the transport scattering rate because of z equals infinity of the localized things, goes linearly in t. And an important precedent for this mechanism of producing a marginal Fermi liquid is from the original paper about marginal Fermi liquid, where their sort of starting point was the existence of some bubble diagram that went like this function, which is the output of this model. And again, at large n, and even with large m, where m is the number of Fermi surface modes, if m is much less than n, the back reaction on the SYK clusters can be controlled. This model has a very interesting phase diagram. If we further allow the bandwidth to be finite, so this calculation isn't exact, the phase diagram looks like this. As a function of temperature, there are basically four phases. So this is the marginal Fermi liquid phase that I was just describing. But in the case when the bandwidth is finite, if you make the temperature too high, you reach a phase which is called an incoherent metal. Basically, what happens is that it becomes one big SYK cluster. Right? We have four fermion interactions between everybody. At high enough temperature, the thing forgets that there's a Fermi surface. There's just one big SYK cluster. This phase was described earlier in a simpler model by these folks. I'll say a little more about that in a second. Yes?
In what sense is a metal if you destroy the Fermi surface and it's just an SYK cluster?
In the sense of transport. Yeah, so I'll say more about this in just a second. So actually, it still has linear T resistivity. If you go above the scale G, which is the if you go too high, it just becomes, you see the lattice, right? That's, nothing's interesting is up there. But if you go too low, it becomes a Fermi liquid, right? This is the fact that the coupling, the perturbation by which we're coupling the itinerant fermions in the SYK clusters is an irrelevant perturbation, which means if you go to too low an energy scale, it just reverts to a Fermi liquid. Let me say a little bit more. So both the incoherent metal and the marginal Fermi liquid have linear T resistivity with different slopes. This is the behavior of the marginal Fermi liquid conductivity. They both violate the Wiedemann-Franz law. That is, it's a measure of to what extent the heat transport and charge transport are being carried by the same thing, which for free fermions is pi squared over 3 is the ratio of the thermal conductivity over T divided by the charge conductivity. And in the marginal Fermi liquid, it's this number times L naught. In the incoherent metal, it's pi squared over 8 instead of pi squared over 3. Let me make a brief comment about this incoherent metal. It was realized in a simpler model by these folks, which is just SYK clusters coupled by quadratic interactions. And their phase, the model, the phase diagram of that model just looks like this. So at low temperatures, it's a Fermi liquid. In these intermediate regime, it's this incoherent metal. And the scale which separates those is just T squared over J. T is the hopping parameter, and J is the J of the SYK model. And so this is a plot of the conductivity, the orange lines are the conductivity, the blue lines are the heat conductivity. It's linear T for T over EC bigger than one. That's this regime here. That's what I mean by incoherent metal. And if you look at when this parameter is less than one, that's over here, it's beautiful parabola here. So it's a beautiful Fermi liquid at low temperature. And so the mechanism for conductivity in this phase is just hopping. It's just tunneling between sites, right? Which is tunneling between sites, which leads, basically you can do high temperature expansion to calculate, the two-point function of J in the Kubo formula, and the answer just goes like 1 over 2. Okay, and that has the consequence that Magneto transport in these two phases is very different. So in particular, which, as I mentioned, is something that actually happens in experiments, in the incoherent metal, since it has no Fermi surface, it has negligible Magneto resistance. So the perturbation theory in hopping that I was just describing, it's valid exactly when the incoherent metal phase happens. And so the longitudinal conductivity comes from this kind of hopping, and the Hall conductivity comes from hopping in a circle. And so because of this, there's no Magneto transport, it just depends weakly on B. In contrast, in the marginal Fermi liquid, there we can study the transport using a quantum Boltzmann equation. This is a slightly complicated formula. We can derive a scaling functions for both the longitudinal conductivity and the Hall conductivity. And the important part for what we'll need is this behavior in the limits. So far, this resistivity saturates at large B. With one more ingredient, something very interesting happens. So let's suppose that the chemical potential varies a little bit from region to region in the sample. So these green dots are meant to represent one value of the chemical potential. The red dots are some slightly different value. And suppose that they occupy approximately equal area fractions of the system. So this is some kind of like mesoscopic or macroscopic disorder in the system, which is not too crazy an idea. And so in that case, we can understand the macroscopic conductivity using this so-called effective medium theory, which is basically hydrodynamics applied to a case where the only conserved quantity is the charge. So because of disorder, there's no energy conservation. There's no momentum conservation. And the solution of this effective medium theory produces a macroscopic conductivity that goes, sorry. With the input of the microscopic conductivities of these islands, the fact that, so on the previous slide, this calculation shows that the longitudinal bit goes like T over B squared, and the Hall bit goes like 1 over B, plugged into this theory, it gives linear in B resistivity. And moreover, it gives this addition in quadrature as dependence on temperature and magnetic field. And the mechanism for the resistivity to grow with B is very simple. It's that the charge is trying to get from one side of the sample to the other, but it's because of its Hall conductivity, local Hall conductivity, it gets deflected. And so the local Hall resistivity increases the length of the path, and by an amount that's proportional to B. So this is a paper from Parrish and Littlewood who studied this effective medium theory. Okay, so this this function looks a lot like this function. A warning about that is that these coefficients don't automatically come out to the right values. I should make that disclaimer. Okay, this is my last slide. Some questions we can now ask. Now that we have a solvable model of a non-Fermi liquid, it's a real system that produces this phase as opposed to just a phenomenology. As I was mentioning in response to Matt, there are quite a few experiments that measure charge fluctuations in the cuprates. So this is some data on it's basically density-density correlations as a function of frequency. I think it's frequency. Frequency. It, for every Q, it's the same plot, right? So it's basically independent of momentum. And with a lot of features that depend on that agree with the marginal Fermi liquid phenomenology. And there are lots of questions about it. So in particular, you know, what can we say about the damping of collective modes in this model? What can we say about the dependence on the doping? What can we say about damping of sound? And let me conclude with a final question, which is my title accurate? So you'll remember that my title was something about strange metal from local quantum chaos, right? So I haven't said anything. I haven't said the word chaos. Maybe I did say the word. I haven't said very much about chaos. And that's related to the fact that there are sort of two aspects of the SYK model as it manifests itself in the literature. One is that it exhibits maximal chaos in the sense that it's out of time order two-point functions grow at some in the right regime of times as fast as they're allowed to. By a theorem of Melda Sanders Shanker and Stanford. This is a property of the physics near the middle of the spectrum, right? It's a statement about finite energy density states and mixing of excitations in those states. And that's to be contrasted with the property of the SYK model that I cared about, which is that at low frequencies, the Green's function was a power law in frequency. Right? That was really the thing I wanted from it. And this is a property of the ground state. And so you might ask, well, can we have one without the other? And an answer that was given to me by Vladimir Rosenhaus is probably not. And that's because this property of local criticality, it's the statement that the thing looks like a zero plus one-dimensional conformal field theory at low frequencies. And that fact by itself, based on our current understanding of nearly first of all, it can't be exactly a zero plus one-dimensional conformal field theory because a zero plus one-dimensional conformal field theory inevitably comes with some kind of cutoff. And so the conformal symmetry is necessarily a little bit broken. And that has the consequence that it's described at low frequencies by this so-called Schwarzian theory, about which I'm not going to say anything, except that that Schwarzian theory immediately implies this maximal Lyapunov exponent. So the answer is yes. I think my title is accurate. That's the end. Thank you for listening.
Right, any questions for
I have a few questions, but one of them is your model where you added this kind of puddle of chemical potential. How could this work for any model that has a linear and resistivity? Would it give this linear
in B? It requires a little bit more input than that. It requires the behavior of these scaling functions at which regime is it? At the smaller argument, I think it. No, let's see. The behavior of the scaling functions at the lower limit. So this is not, I think, is not an automatic consequence of linear two resistivity. Here's the reason I know. The incoherent metal also has linear T resistivity, but I know for sure that it won't have this kind of magnetic resistance. Yeah, so it definitely also depends on the magnetic field dependence of the local conductivity. Yeah, so there is a bit more input than that.
Do your coupling fermions to SYK clusters, do you have any physical intuition of what the SYK clusters are?
Some d-orbitals.
But,
yeah, it goes up to 10, right? No, I'm joking. I'm joking a little bit. I think, people think that the cuprates are well described by just a single band Hubbard model, right? So that's... To the extent that that's true, obviously this isn't the right description. On the other hand, there are some heavy fermion materials where there are a lot more mixed valency things, like a lot more orbitals that can participate. So I think it's actually not so crazy as a cartoon, maybe a little bit extreme cartoon of those kinds of things. And I guess I should mention this: strange metal behavior doesn't just happen in the cuprates; it happens in lots of other things. So the mixed valence is the picture I have in mind for making it a little more realistic.
But if I understood correctly, you were trying to describe that part in the phase diagram above the superconducting dome, right?
Yes.
Have you explored whether this model is unstable towards superconductivity and whether you should say something about like high CC?
That's ambitious. Certainly it does have many instabilities. So in particular, The SYK clusters themselves are unstable to perturbations by local quadratic couplings. That's not a superconducting instability, but it is an instability. There is actually a little bit of work on superconducting instabilities of such SYK models by Cenk and Nussbaum. But I haven't thought about it carefully. But certainly it's unstable. Whether the dominant instability is to superconductivity, I kind of doubt, but I don't know.